Hello, we are the Righteous Rumble podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. I'm Jimmy, and I voted Leave in the EU referendum in 2016.
And I'm Jasmine, and I'm so tired, I'm really tired, and I just don't want to leave the European Union. Why can't I have my way? Why?
You're getting whinier as these go on. So we meet up to talk about current affairs, social issues and politics and all that jazz.
On a weekly basis.
On a weekly basis.
More or less.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're joined... sorry, am I meant to be picking up that baton? And,
yeah, you do that.
Oh, I'm so grumpy. And we're joined this week by Taha.
Hello.
How are you, Taha?
I'm great. I'm fantastic.
Do you want to introduce yourself and say what you do, who you are, why you're here?
Okay.
just a few basic questions.
I'm Taha. On the internet, I go by Can't Stop Me.
That's... Oh, pun.
God. At some point, I'll get sick of it. And I am a PPE student, so I guess...
You know, politics and stuff.
I can do things.
Which is politics, economics, and ethics.
Definitely.
No, politics, that's philosophy, and economics.
Yeah.
There we go. Well done, Jasmine.
Yeah, and I specialised in economics.
Yeah. So to celebrate, we're going to not be talking about economics.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, so is that how you want to be defined? Do you not want to be defined as a YouTuber?
Oh, yeah, I do YouTube.
Although you tweet a lot more than you upload.
Yeah, so I...
Exponentially more.
I would consider myself an online personality rather than just a YouTuber.
An online personality.
What's your YouTube channel about then?
So I generally just try and just be stupid and funny. I've just uploaded a video that's about politics, but before that I haven't really done anything politics related.
You have been on the podcast
literally,
before, though.
Yeah, you can co-host it.
You've been on the Right to Sorrowable before.
Yeah.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. No, yeah, like, I said the PPE thing because I felt like it was more relevant, but...
Oh, that's not why you're here.
I'm here for the... Sorry, I'm here to rake in the views.
Yeah, precisely.
Sweet views.
Well, the listeners.
Oh, yeah. Details.
What a thing.
Well, what are we going to be talking about, Jazza?
So this week, we are going to be talking about a few diversity things because it's really fun to have Jimmy rip me a new one. Mm. So there were riots in North London after the death of a young man called Rashan Charles in police custody. There's a lot of confusion about what he, like the circumstances surrounding his death still, we're still not sure. But there was the head of the Black and Ethnic Minority Society in Cambridge, Jason Okunde, was kind of dragged on the internet by certain members of the mainstream press for apparently tweeting that all white people are racists.
I mean, he did tweet that.
He did, actually, literally, the words all white people are racist in his tweet. Yep. But it is slightly more nuanced than that, I believe.
And he was fairly, you know, fairly celebratory around all the smashing of stuff.
Yes, which we will talk about later.
Yeah, but he wrote an article in The Guardian about how he was unfairly maligned and, you know, the MSM man, it, you know, biases people and stuff.
Yeah, MSM being not Comic-Con, but the mainstream media.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the two.
Oh, no, that's MC. Never mind. And then what else are we talking about, Jimmy?
I said this is kind of the same topic, but Jazza doesn't believe me. over the weekend, a Googler, or former Googler now, by the name of James Damore, that was the name, right?
James of Love.
Yeah.
That's how it translates.
He wrote what seems to have been described as an anti-diversity screed.
What is a screed?
It's like a sort of rant, like a polemic against something.
Right.
It's a negative, it's a pejorative phrase, basically. They were saying, and the way it was portrayed in the media is that this was, you know, flagrantly bigoted manifesto that, you know, attacked the idea of diversity. In reality, if you read the manifesto, I at least think it's quite reasonable. It does correlate with my views, but it's at least like...
It's presented reasonably.
It's quite mildly presented. Whatever you think of the nature of the views, whether you think the views are completely wrong, it's not
like reading Breitbart.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like a Saga under the CAD video or something like that. But yeah, he's now lost his job. Sundar Pichai, is that his name, has flown back, the Google CEO, from his holidays to, I don't know.
Both. Her and I have just had to look that up. Sundar Pichai?
I mean, don't look at me.
Anyway, the Google CEO has had to fly back, you know.
So from holidays.
That's the real tragedy.
It's all hands on deck. And, you know, the alt-right has gone crazy.
Pray for Sundar.
So, yeah, we're talking about free speech and diversity and stuff.
Yeah, classics. Yeah. Oh, and also the UK data protection laws.
Yeah, I was about to, you know, introduce that as a third topic.
Would you like to?
Okay, so the UK government has announced that we're introducing this amazing new piece of legislation, which is really just a copy of the EU legislation that we're obliged to implement anyway until we leave the European Union.
Mm-hmm. Which
might not happen. It's going to be a gradual rowing back until I actually get... It's not going to happen. Sorry, guys.
We'll get you there eventually, Joey.
And basically, the main thing that we want to talk about, it sort of strengthens the citizens' rights over data, particularly the so-called right to be forgotten, or what is properly known as the right of erasure, i.e. you can contact a company and ask them to delete any personal information they have on you. There's some exemptions to that, which I'm sure we'll go into, but that's kind of the gist of it. And it's a massive thing for tech companies because a lot of tech companies have essentially built their businesses around the retention of vast amounts of data.
Mm-hmm. I mean, most of them.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting.
Excellent.
And there's also lots of fines for misbehaving companies and that sort of thing. So I'm sure we'll go into that.
It's going to be a rave.
Should we play music and do the thing?
If you like.
Hello, dear listener, it's Jazza here. So sorry to interrupt your regular scheduled programming, but I just want to remind you guys that we have launched a Patreon. Patreon exists so that you are able to financially reward and support people on projects that are creating stuff that you think is worthwhile, and hopefully we fall into that category for you guys. We have a series of rewards from joining our live streams that we're going to be starting at the end of this month and the beginning of next month. To merch, we're going to have pins and mugs that are going to have the Writers on the Wall logo on them. They're going to be really cool, all the way up to being able to be a guest on the show, which is very exciting. Please do check it out. You can go to patreon.com/writedishonorable and at least have a look and see how we're doing and see if you're down for any of the tiers of supporters that we have. Thank you so much anyway for listening, and let's get on with the show.
Jason Akunde, who is the president of the BME, the Black Minority Ethnic Campaign at Cambridge University, was widely criticised, to put it lightly, in a lot of the mainstream media for posting some somewhat inflammatory tweets about race relations in response to the riots in North London that occurred after the death of Rashaan Charles in police custody. He posted the following tweet, and a quote, all white people are racists, white middle class, white working class, white men, white women, white gays, white children, they can all get it. And he also posted a number of other tweets that were supportive of the people who were rioting and partaking in violence as part of the protests against the death. Jimmy, what do you think of him, of our Jason?
As a person?
I mean, and also his conduct.
Well, he's not going to be the first person to complain about being misconstrued on Twitter, but it's not that surprising that if you say all white people are racist, some people are going to take exception to that. Mm-hmm. I realise that's something that a lot of sort of race relations activists think, or at least on some subconscious level, that everyone's racist. But I think most people...
Everyone's a little bit racist.
Yeah, yeah. Most people, I think, probably don't see themselves as racist.
But does that... Does that mean they're not racist?
I mean, on an unconscious or subconscious level, doesn't necessarily mean that that's the case, but...
So this is something that I've talked about on the podcast before. I think when our friend Carl was here, Sargon of Akkad.
Carl Benjamin, here. Yeah.
Yeah, Carl Benjamin. We must not say his internet name. Yeah, I know, it's annoying. We talked about the idea of kind of different definitions of racism being used in different contexts and how often when people like Jason, for example, talk about white people being racist, they aren't necessarily talking about individual prejudices and the idea that a white person actively thinks that black people are terrible or that people from Poland shouldn't be here. But it is an ingrained system of... that's happened over centuries of black and brown people being repressed and the favour being stacked against them in the system of our society. Mm. That's what I kind of understand as racism, and when we use kind of like that big word to describe our society as racist.
Yeah. I mean, what he says is that he meant that all white people can be racist, not that they necessarily all are racist. This was in the Guardian article he wrote, and he also... was quoted in The Independent kind of clarifying his position. So
he was critical of the fact that quite often racism seems to be, especially post-Brexit, seems to be focused and criticised towards white working class people, and that it is purely a vice of people of that demographic.
Right.
And I think that with his clarification in the Guardian article and various other things that he's put online to clarify his point, I think that he is right to say that we probably shouldn't just be saying that racism is something that exists only in working class areas.
I don't think very many people would say that.
I think a lot of people do, especially post-Brexit.
It's possibly true that racism is more common among working class people. I don't know how you'd test that.
My initial thought to that comment is that that's untrue.
Right.
So,
but it either is true or isn't true, right? I mean, it's quite unlikely that racism is equally distributed. It's the same among middle-class people and working-class people. That just seems unlikely as a general thing.
And then also, when we are talking about the structural racism in society, it's also not helpful to talk about specific demographics of people, I think. And it is very confusing to talk about those two types of racism, one being more prejudiced and one being structural, and trying to have those nuanced discussions around it. And also the fact that these were tweets...
They weren't well pitched, even as tweets go.
No, but I don't think that he was expecting the Daily Mail and quite a lot of other papers to then decide to post images of him scowling.
Right,
and then calling him reverse racist.
This is a guy who's a representative of a campaign group, so he's a public face, and he was tweeting about the very subject that his campaign's involved in.
Mm-hmm.
So, in what sense is it illegitimate for a newspaper to quote him?
I think the manner in which he was quoted was out of context, as we now know from the clarifications that
he
made.
I also think, on a wider narrative level, when you look at the reporting of the riots, this is like a sidestep from what is actually going on. I kind of see it as like, okay, we've moved the discussion to this one guy, and we've now got a person to like rally around and antagonize.
Rather than talking about the death of Rashaan Charles, which is probably something that deserves more attention than a few tweets.
I'm pretty sure they have covered that story. This is a follow-on story. You know, I totally understand why people would cover this.
Be the follow-on story? Like, this is... I do feel like...
I mean, you read newspapers, right? You do you know how sort of news gathering works?
Right, but
this is a fairly basic point.
But I do feel like this is... this is, like, so inconsequential.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's
a young guy live-tweeting an event that is relevant to his community.
Yes. But he is representative of a BME campaign, right?
Sure, but I also think that it's quite different when it's a student campaign and when it's not on like a national level.
It's Cambridge Union. right? It's Cambridge Student Union. It's a significant university.
I don't believe it's technically the student union. It's part of the BME campaign group.
Right, okay.
Which isn't affiliated with the...
He's just at Cambridge.
Yeah.
Okay, but...
So what were you going to say?
Yeah, sorry.
I was just saying, I just thought that was something that we should keep in mind when talking about it, is that it isn't... I feel it's being... The narrative is all the newspapers are focusing on this very inconsequential thing.
Don't have to talk about...
So that there's less...
Police brutality and whether or not people of colour do get treated worse, which there's data that shows that broadly they do get treated worse than...
Because what they've done is that they've just taken, look at this person at Cambridge University.
That is what you just suggested is a very... I mean, I find it interesting, but it's from a general point of view, a mushy, unstructured story. Whereas this is a story about a person saying a thing.
Yeah. Right? But I think that is a failing of the way that the mainstream media chose to cover the story.
It's a failure of the way human brains work, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is it's an obvious story. It's, mm-hmm. A diversity campaign is something saying something that on the face of it is horrendously unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, I think it's fine to cover, to be honest with you.
I also think it's a testament to the mess of vocabulary in race relations.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a somewhat unpopular opinion on how we should be talking about race.
What's that? Do tell. Did you tweet this in hashtag my unpopular opinion or something that was on Twitter the other day?
I didn't, but I did tweet about it a couple years ago and got a lot of backlash.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that I think that even in these tweets, it's clear that when you saw the tweets, you saw him at referencing this wider structural
mm-hmm.
Issue within society of racism. And that's where your reference point of the word racism was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But for people, across the political spectrum, it becomes... It absolutely
for people
that.
Who... And I think about this a lot because of my degree and the kind of stuff that I do online. And so
it's very sort of it's a very academic definition that's been placed upon this word that's very commonly used and mm-hmm. has a lot of weight, which is this structural, racism describes this structural oppression that ethnic minorities face, whereas the layman's definition isn't that at all. It's discrimination based on race.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this sort of blurring of the two definitions without actually having two words for it. And the thing that I said was that we should absolutely just keep the definition of racism as racism based on race, so that everyone is clear and on board and understands what...
You mean direct, tangible discrimination?
Right. Mm-hmm. Not... Yeah, I mean...
So signs like no blacks, no dogs, no Irish. That kind of
ostensible discrimination.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but also you could say that something when it's discrimination based on race, it's racism.
Right.
But then we need a word for this description of structural oppression, and I feel like you should just call it racial oppression. And I feel like what's happened is in these tweets, he's talking about racial oppression and how. White people can reinforce this racial mm-hmm. oppression, but because his understanding of the word racism is racial oppression, it's become messy because he's using a different definition
mm-hmm.
To the, I guess, the majority of society. And what we're doing is we're essentially locking out the rest of the world or a majority of society to the conversation because of this messy
mm-hmm.
Distinction.
Yeah.
I don't want to turn this into a conversation about semantics, he says, as he turns this into a conversation about semantics. But I agree with you that there do need to be two kind of distinctions. But I think that racism more accurately and more usefully describes the structural oppression that exists. And I think that prejudice describes the racism that most people define as racism. Mm. And so I think that because people are I have a black friend, so it's fine. And it's well, of course you're not actively prejudiced against him. but because of the structures that surround you and your black friend, you both live in a racist society, and your, in many ways, your existence and your conduct in this world contribute to his, the racism that he or she feels.
But see, the thing is, you're fighting a losing battle with that argument, though, because his definition, his use of racism, is the common use of racism.
And also, I feel like racial oppression has more clarity. Also, I would also define racism as prejudice based on race.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah.
Also, it's a very unpopular opinion in the circles that I sit in.
Why is it an unpopular opinion?
Because it's, it just means you just have to... It's just, like, not some... Most people... When I talk about race with them, they understand the alt definition.
No!
And all this, this newer definition that's been sort of very intellectualized. And
isn't part of the point of academics, though, and just kind of race theorists in general, that part of the problem is language, and therefore they've created a new system of new words and new concepts that's captivated in that language, because it wasn't there before. So when they talk about, say, microaggressions, for instance, there's no word that really conveys that concept.
And I feel like what... It's like, I feel like this topic, the issue of the guy tweeting this stuff, is like a symptom of a massive misstep in developing the language, because this is now... This is like one of the biggest barriers whenever someone says something, when they're referring to... if they had said racial oppression causes blah, 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 but when they say the word racism, it sometimes becomes incoherent because of the two different reference points. And then newspapers can jump on it and be like, look at how terrible this is on face value, because they're using a different reference point.
I wanted to ask you, Jimmy, like, we disagree on how justified this story is in terms of furthering the narrative of what has happened.
Well, I think newspapers exist to sell papers, basically. And I think the commercial imperative is the main thing.
Damn, whereas capitalism.
You talk about narratives and, I mean, they are trying to spin a narrative, but because it sells newspapers,
I would disagree that there isn't an ideological
thing. Okay, the ideological reason is not the prime objective. It might be in service to the secondary one, which is money.
That's another conversation. But do you? So the question I wanted to ask you was: do you think that the coverage that he received was fair? I mean, so maybe Cambridge University BME rep tweets these things about like violence in North London. Yeah. Maybe that is a justified story. But do you think that the way that he was portrayed, in terms of like the images that were used, and in terms of like the way that his tweets were like, lacked context, do you think that that was fair? And also the fact that he was forced out of the closet because of the way that they portrayed him. Jason is a gay.
The homophobia thing.
Out to his whole family.
He was accused of homophobia for criticising how gay people are racist in certain contexts, right? And that was that covered by the Daily Mail in their article? Because I would have thought that would have been less interest to them than the...
I think it was covered in the Telegraph.
Right? Yeah.
Telegraph, okay. I mean, if... He's come out as gay publicly to demonstrate that he's not homophobic, although you would say that being gay yourself is no barrier to being homophobic, so...
Yeah.
That's the kind of a strange thing in of itself. I mean, I think it's...
And also his anecdote of being a gay man of colour is one that I am aware of. Like,
right.
there is probably more, to use Taha's definition of, like, racism, there's more blatant racism of I don't like you because of the colour of your skin in the gay community than I think there is in a lot of demographics.
I don't like you or I won't date you?
It's both.
Right.
I'm not interested in talking to people. No blacks, no Asians.
Right.
It are literally words that you see on dating profiles.
Your original question was: were his words misconstrued? I mean, if you believe his account in The Guardian,
do you believe his account in The Guardian?
No, but I mean, there's blatant, like, he doesn't really cover the fact that he advocated smashing stuff, and he was all over he was quite pro-violence in his tweets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a deliberate omission there, which makes me doubt the rest of his account. And I think if you tweet something like, all white people are racist, you have to expect that some people are going to interpret that in a certain way that is not going to paint you in an enviable light. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, was the Daily Mail fair? The Daily Mail is not a fair newspaper. That's not the reason the Daily Mail exists. You know, most of the stuff that the Daily Mail writes about, it is not coming at it from an objective, impartial point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody doubts when they buy the Daily Mail what direction they're pitching from. So it seems to be kind of an irrelevant question.
I don't know. I think that there was, and he writes about this in the Guardian article, I think there was overt racism in the way that they portrayed him, especially in terms of like the images that they chose to show of him, and the examples of the tweets that they use and all that kind of stuff. And also the deliberate lack of nuance that they decided to put surrounding the tweets. And obviously the Daily Mail is not known for its nuance. But I think, especially when you're talking about something like race relations, it might be something that's a little bit better.
It's hard to see.
I want the Daily Mail to be something that it's not.
It's hard to see how the context would have sort of made it more obvious what he thought he was saying without seeing the tweets in full. And the trouble with a lot of these tweet stories is that the news breaks and then the offending social media items are deleted, and then there's no way really of verifying who said what and what is true and what isn't. But, you know, I think what he said was kind of deplorable in a lot of ways, certainly the smashing stuff. Mm-hmm. And if he was misconstrued, I think it's because his tweets were ambiguous to start with, you know, for reasons already discussed.
So moving on, why is Sundar Pichai having to, if that's how you pronounce his name, this is terrible.
Can we just call him the Google CEO?
The Google CEO.
Google CEO. Google chief.
Yeah. Google boss. He had to cut his holiday short. Because somebody put a anti-diversity manifesto.
Manifesto is the neutral term.
That circulated around Google employees. Could you kind of break down what this manifesto said to us, Jimmy?
So basically this...
As the representative of people who have these opinions.
As a representative of all white people.
Yes. No, please.
But all white people that are racist that we know.
But which version of racism are we using, Taha? That is the question.
You've left so much ambiguous. So basically, James Damore posted this, let's call it a manifesto for the sake of argument, kind of detailing his objections to the diversity policies within Google, but not diversity per se. So he says actually at the start, I value diversity and inclusion, I'm not denying that sexism exists and don't endorse using stereotypes, which all seems fairly agreeable. And he talks about this concept of psychological safety in reference to the idea that certain political opinions are seen as heresy and are not acceptable and you can't discuss them. And given the fact that after he wrote this manifesto, he was fired, more or less demonstrates that he was correct in that. But I think the manifesto, broadly speaking, is correct. I think it's quite reasonably written, even if you disagree with its conclusions. The gist of it is that...
It's a very level-headed, thoughtful document that I think is wrong.
Yes, there you go. And his whole point was, like, we should be able to reasonably discuss these issues. And he thinks that men and women on average are different. And therefore, if you're looking at sort of a broad sample, i.e. work representation in the US in this context, you're going to get different numbers in different roles. So he's specifically saying there's no reason to think that coders at Google or software engineers at Google will necessarily be 50-50 male and female if no sort of outside discrimination or barriers existed, just because men and women on average have different attributes and different talents and different preferences. That's the gist of what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I think that's, you know, that's broadly my view as well. I can't really talk about coding specifically, but I think in terms of the general labour market, I think that's probably true.
Mm-hmm. Taha, what do you think?
I mean, it's really convincing, and I'm not 100% sure where I sit on it yet. So I'm at the position right now where I feel like what is being reported and what he said in the actual manifesto are slightly different.
How so?
Well, it's being reported like he's saying that the gap that exists because of biology.
Mm-hmm.
Where I feel like what he said in the manifesto is that on if there were no structural issues, we would not get a 50-50 split.
Yeah, I mean, one thing he does say is that we shouldn't assume that a gender gap in a lot of scenarios necessarily means discrimination is taking place, mm-hmm. which is...
And I think what is being reported is we should... is the flip side to that, which is that it's being reported that he said... How do I phrase this?
That he's denying that sexism exists? Or
right, that like we should... that it's never... that.
Yeah, I mean, he does. I mean, he even says it in his opening statement. He says sexism does exist, and I think the way that the most outlets, particularly outlets on the left, have reported this is saying like women don't belong in software engineering. The Google diversity chief released a statement which was like, this has made a lot of women feel uncomfortable. They feel as though they're not valued at the company. And if you read the manifesto properly, that would not be your inference from it, because that is not what he's saying. He's not saying that no women should be software engineers.
He's saying that we shouldn't be making sure that as many women become software engineers as possible.
No, that's also not what he's saying. He actually, there's a section in the manifesto where he says that quotas and positive discrimination and programs for specific, mm-hmm. say, genders or specific ethnicities, he thinks those are wrong. Mm-hmm. He thinks they're counterproductive and that they don't work.
Yeah, that's where I kind of disagree with.
But he suggests like a whole load of other measures that he thinks can help. For instance, he suggests that part-time work should be more fully endorsed because he thinks women prefer part-time work to men, for instance. Mm-hmm. He's saying that Google should make changes to encourage more women aboard, but they shouldn't assume that they're ever going to get 50-50 split in like a particular department or whatever. And he's saying that, as I said, on average, the different sexes are not necessarily biologically suited for the same roles, on average.
Okay, shall I do my academic thing now?
Yeah.
So I have an issue with the idea that you shouldn't be trying to control for the lower number of women who, in the current setup that we have in kind of like academia and careers, that we shouldn't be trying to get more women into especially coding and like technological building jobs, because you end up having there is kind of like this belief that the algorithm can be neutral, and that the algorithm, if you just build it and let it machine learn, then it's just going to be able to be this grand neutral thing that works for everybody. And that is a big philosophy that exists within especially Silicon Valley.
So you're saying that you want women involved in the coding process because you think otherwise it will tend towards male preferences?
Not necessarily it will tend towards male preferences, but it will end up throwing up problems that will not have been caught if women or people of colour or LGBT people were in that process. There's loads of examples.
Such as what?
There are loads of examples of this throughout technology. Quite stark one is the fact that Canon created a camera that couldn't recognise Asian people, that couldn't recognise faces.
Mm.
We have very recently the LGBT accidental block in restricted mode on YouTube that we talked about at length on this podcast. And these things get thrown up as like the, oh God, we've built something that actually does something quite evil. And the more diversity that you involve in the
something that I noticed when reading up about this is that there are actually disproportionate numbers of, say, transgender people in tech in Silicon Valley,
mm-hmm.
and presumably some of them are involved somewhere involved in YouTube in some way. Like mm-hmm. there must be employees of that kind at Google. I think the fact that it wasn't caught doesn't necessarily... it's not necessarily a good justification.
I think that trans representation in Silicon Valley probably has more to do with benefits in healthcare and policies that companies have.
Yep, it might do, but your point was we need representation to catch these problems. I think some of these problems are kind of obvious anyway.
No, sure, but people don't catch those problems, and I think that a lot of that does have to do with the homogeneity of the types of people who are creating the systems that we use.
Mm.
And I think that it's impossible for you to be critical of the systems that you use if you don't take into account who is actually building them.
But actually, that's kind of...
That's also a well-documented thing. When you have algorithms that are machine learning, who the biases of the coders do play into, especially on aggregate, when they're learning over time, the biases come out.
Such as what, exactly?
Whatever the biases of the code is. So, which sometimes comes... Well, especially when the code is interacting with the real world.
Right.
Like in the Canon case... If a white coder is coding for faces, it's likely that if they are in an area that doesn't have many Asians, then they don't pay as much attention to coding for things that coding for facial features that may not be present.
So the Canon thing was a facial detection
issue,
thing, right? Yeah. Shouldn't it just have been tested on a lot of different types of faces?
Sure, but that, because of the nature of the people who were running the project, was not something that was thought of.
I don't know.
That wasn't something that was seen as a technical flaw of a product that then got released to the general public.
But that just seems like dumb testing policies.
Yeah, but I would say that you are going to less likely have dumb testing policies if you include more people who are going to be affected by the technology that you
do
create.
Do we agree that diversity increases the number of perspectives that we have?
I think it depends. I'm not actually convinced on this demography point. Because I think, for instance, the Jason, what was his surname? Akunde.
Yeah.
Is a black guy who was privately educated and went to Cambridge. I think if you found a white guy who was privately educated at the same school, and I know the school, and went to Cambridge, you'd probably find a large overlap in terms of their worldview. You know, just about everything. And the fact that they're of different races...
I don't know.
Not necessarily that significant in the scheme of things. What I would say is within...
Oh, I disagree with that.
Okay. within like white people, there's more of a variance of perspectives on the world than there is between, say, whites on average and blacks on average.
But there is... go on, Tyler.
And the same...
Say that again?
Within like a particular race, like white, black or whatever... Right. There's a wider variance of perspectives on the world than there are between the differences between any particular race.
Okay, I can agree with that.
But
right,
there,
so
but
if you want
specific...
if you want differences of perspective, then demography, i.e. race, and also gender, they're not necessarily good vectors for that.
But then the things that specifically affect those demographics, whether they be women or queer people or people of colour, are going to be specific to people of those backgrounds, right? What were you going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say something similar, that, okay, there might not be... the variances within races are going to be more than between them, but there will still be some that on average are different between them. And that difference needs to be accounted for, and the only way you could do that is through diversity.
I also kind of find
I think if you're going for diversity of perspective... It doesn't. You should hire on that basis, and you may end up with an ethnically diverse workforce anyway, just as a result of doing that. I wouldn't question that. But going for it the other way, you want a diversity of perspectives, and therefore you do it on the basis of race. That seems to me to be backwards.
No, but I feel like
you're criticizing method.
Yeah, probably. Well, because I think the business case is all around different perspectives, right? We need different perspectives because it will make our product or our company more innovative. But I'm saying that different perspectives probably come more from just hiring people who have different personalities, different ways of thinking about the world, than it does just looking at the surface features, which are things like sex and race.
I also want to just bring it back to this manifesto that he's got. And I've come across this statistical distribution that he's put up here, and which I feel like is the crux of his argument. You know, he's got these two distributions of...
So these are the two bell curves.
Yeah.
If people are familiar with bell curves.
And he said...
It looks like a couple of boobies.
You've seen boobs before, mate.
I haven't seen breasts for a while, to be fair.
And he's essentially said that, okay, so the populations on average have different medians.
Yeah.
But there's so much overlap anyway, that if this is in any way used as the crux of his argument, which it is...
No, I mean, he actually deliberately references that In the way that he says you should treat people as individuals. So you shouldn't like assume that just because a woman is interviewing for a position, she therefore must be bad at software engineering because she's a woman. Because
how very generous of him.
Well, this argument's been massively misconstrued. I'm trying to like explain what his point of view is, mm-hmm. and the point of view is, and it's kind of like height. All right, in the UK, the average height for a man is like 5'10". The average height for a woman is like 5'4", or around about then. Therefore, as Tahar said to you, the median male is significantly taller than the median female, but there are a lot of women who are taller than the average man, right?
Yeah.
That's all he's saying, but he's saying coding instead of height.
But then, for example, if we're going to continue with this height analogy, there are specific problems that shorter people who are men are going to encounter that shorter people who are women do not encounter. Would you agree with that?
For example?
For example, being told that you have a Napoleon complex rather than being told that you're petite. In the way that you are kind of...
Yeah, you're losing me with this metaphor, to be honest with you.
I mean, you started with the fucking height thing. But
the height thing is a standard fucking, like, distribution graph thing.
But it is...
And everyone gets it, and nobody denies it because it's a physical difference, and therefore you can measure it.
No, yeah, sure. But I don't think that it's hugely helpful. I don't think that there is a huge amount of evidence that women are worse at coding than men. I think women are are less likely to go into the professions of coding than men because of the cultures that surround them, because they aren't pushed into those careers when they are younger. Because
well, he's emphasising biology, you're emphasising culture. So that's the kind of fundamental difference.
But I feel like he's just ignoring. Oblivious to that point.
Which point?
The point of culture, where I feel like perhaps...
No, because he says sexism exists, and sexism is obviously a facet of culture, isn't it? And he also acknowledges stereotypes, which is another facet of culture.
So, Taha, I don't know if you'll agree with me with this, because I don't code particularly well, but I do code, and I'm really aware that there are many different ways of being able to build something within like whatever interface you're using. And quite often, there are lots of different paths to be able to get to the same point.
Mm.
And so I think it's less of a idea of people with this kind of biology are better at coding than people with this kind of biology.
Yes, because... it's definitely the institutional practices.
Yeah.
So I've done logic, which is essentially coding abstracted from a specific language. And there is definitely, when interacting with classmates, definitely different ways of reaching the conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But there is one way that they want you to use in the exam, and that's more difficult for some people, but you can get to the same conclusion through a different methodology.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel like there is something to be said that perhaps the sexes don't have a difference.
I'm assuming what you're saying is because like Silicon Valley is a bit of a boys club, they're used to doing things a certain way, and because women are not so involved, they can't do things their way, even though their way is just as good as the boys' way.
I would kind of argue that it's like saying that men are better at writing fiction than men are better at writing fiction than women. That is just a ridiculous statement, because there are different ways of writing fiction and creating great pieces of
Coding's an engineering problem.
In many ways, it's an engineering
problem. It's called software engineering.
No, it's an engineering problem that requires a lot more lateral thinking than like building a bridge.
Mm.
And that's why I have a huge issue with the idea that women aren't as good at coding as men. It's because as Taha was saying, all of the... kind of like solutions to things have always been so defined by a male-dominated industry that a lot of female brains that are perhaps because of biology better at certain things than men, it's a lot more difficult for women to transfer into this male-dominated structure that doesn't need to be male-dominated, because actually you can get a lot more variance and a lot more efficient coding if you approach these problems from different directions.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I've got that enough.
Oh my god, we win!
I mean, I definitely saw it in logic, because it was... I found that...
in some solutions you could be far more elegant in a way that I hadn't thought about.
Like I have a friend who's a PhD at the Oxford Internet Institute, and like is one of the I'm not a fantastic coder, so I'm not aware of this firsthand, but I'm told that she's one of the most fantastic coders that have ever kind of like crossed the crossed the hearth, crossed the door, has come to the OII, and people like guys who had been coding for like a decade or more were really frustrated that she could write a piece of code. She'd been learning coding for like a year, and she was able to write a piece of code in three lines that would take them 10.
Okay.
Because she was able to think in a different way to them.
This guy, James DeMore, his theory doesn't preclude women who are excellent at coding.
Right, but what would you say if the three lines of code are non-standard? And so
that's exactly what happens, yeah.
Like the 10 lines of code is what they want.
I don't know. Like
that's the problem, is that especially in the logic stuff that I do, it's, oh, well, you got to the conclusion, but it wasn't in the hoops that we need it, even though your solution is...
I mean, I'm assuming that if, you know, something could be written in three lines of code rather than 10, most coders would be fine by that, assuming that it connects to all the other things.
Yeah, but so much of coding is winging it anyway. You have to kind of come up with a solution to it by, going to Stack Overflow more than anything.
As I said, this I don't know a lot about coding, so I'm going to kind of dodge these technical questions, but nor do you, for that matter. But
I know enough.
I mean, it still might be correct that there are more men that want to be coders than women, for instance. And that might be, on some level, down to biology, which is all he's
saying.
Then
I would argue, and I think that Google would argue, that results in a worse product.
Right, so are you suggesting that they should, even though there's a wider pool of male candidates available in our hypothesis,
if they want their...
they should hire equal amounts, 50-50?
I don't know, but I don't like the idea of quotas, but I think that you should...
But is 50-50 the ideal goal?
If you were going to make black and white painting, and you had...
Is it a racist black and white? Sorry.
And you had 80 litres of black paint and 20 litres of white paint, would you not want 20 of each?
Oh, that's such a poetic
way. I don't know, it depends on the fucking painting, doesn't it?
Exactly. I feel like that actually demonstrates the point. I want us to close this off because we've chatted about this a bit too much. But I do find it quite funny that a guy is criticising the hiring and firing practices of one of the most successful companies in the world, because clearly whatever Google are doing broadly is working.
I mean, they didn't do this for a very long time, which is why. I also just want in to fact, point actually, out. As it stands, the overwhelming majority of their coders are male. So if they're doing something right, then they should not hire women.
But now they're rectifying it, right?
Yeah, but like
I say, rectifying—that's a very loaded term.
They've done really well with mostly male coders.
Mm-hmm. I do also want to say, if that's your argument, I don't really think it's the best. Like, I don't think it's the best put together paper, because I can just see like there are things in here, like, you know, just skimming through it, you can see things like women on average are more prone to anxiety. It's just a bullet point, but when there's like a huge amount of
this guy does have a PhD in computational biology from Harvard.
Okay, but
I'd assume he knows a little bit about what he's talking about.
Let me cite like a lot of studies that prove that.
I mean, I think that the point that women are more prone to anxiety than men is fairly well documented.
But also, it's well documented that men are less likely to come forward with anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yep.
So that there is no way to say it's concretely. Very
difficult,
yeah.
It's difficult to say, but it is suggestive. The manifesto has some problems, but you can sort of argue that in terms of it arguing different skills are distributed in different places than for men and for women on average. That's probably true, I think, depending on how narrow the skill set is you're looking at. And in terms of him being fired, which we actually didn't cover very much, I think it does prove its point that Silicon Valley does actually have a problem with disagreement on certain things that it holds to be sacrosanct.
I actually disagree with that, just because I think he was fired on an optics
basis. I think they had to fire him. Yeah.
But I mean, the fact that he had to be fired because it looked bad, if they didn't fire him, does prove my point anyway, basically.
So having worked at a Silicon Valley company,
Facebook.
Yeah, I would argue that actually there's almost an encouragement of dissenting views. They are often there is very clearly a philosophy that drives a lot of what happens in these tech companies, especially when you have a benevolent leader like Zuckerberg.
Benevolent, maybe not the right word.
And I don't. It's a word. and I think that there is definitely a culture of questioning, but I think that it's so closed off that not many people actually experience it.
Right, I mean, we covered actually a while back Amazon, which allegedly, according to a New York Times article, has a very aggressive, combatorial working culture. I mean, the thing is with the Google thing is he said, yeah, we encourage people to express themselves, but he also fired someone for writing something that I don't think was very inflammatory.
Yeah, no, but just I agree with Taha. Just because it upset people. They have to because of how it looks.
Well, I think he... Frankly, I think he made the wrong decision. I accept, obviously, it looked bad. But
now he's going to go and work at WikiLeaks, so...
Yeah, Julian Assange has offered him a job.
Great.
But yeah. Okay, we can move on now to data protection.
Thank you. Can you describe this British version of The Right to be Forgotten, please?
So The Right to be Forgotten was originally a court ruling on a Spanish lawyer, I think, who wanted some news stories about his former bankruptcy to be removed from the top of Google's search engine when people looked up his name. And Google has since had to remove thousands and thousands of entries, so that if you search for a lot of people's names in Google now, when you're within the EU or you're coming from an EU IP address, it won't show you certain results. There's certain exemptions for various things. But this idea has kind of been expanded in what's technically known as the right of erasure, which is under the General Data Protection Regulation.
Sounds like an album from the 80s.
Yeah, I guess so. Under the General Data Protection Regulation, which is coming into effect in May 2018, you have the right to go to companies and say, you've got a load of personal information on me, can you delete it? You have the right to do that, and assuming that they don't have like a compelling reason, i.e. a legal compliance reason or something like that, they have to agree to your request and delete it. Why do you think this is interesting, Jazza?
I think this is interesting because of the broad point that does get debated an awful lot, but I'm interested in whether we should have the right to have our histories erased from the internet. Do you not think that there should be a certain amount of consequence to the actions that we do online?
So in terms of the original court case, obviously this Spanish guy had gone bankrupt, but it was a long time ago. The newspapers had written up accurate stories about it, and they had published them online.
Accurate, you say?
No, nothing about it was untrue. It wasn't defamatory. It was a correct portrayal of what happened to him. But we do also have this idea in English law that, for instance, if you're a convict and you've only served a set amount of time in jail and you're released, your next employer is not allowed to request your criminal records or anything like that. So, and obviously if they Googled your name and you'd committed a significant enough crime...
They can get around that law.
So there's a kind of meeting between those two things that I think needs to happen. The worry is that like public officials or people who are, no offence to the Spanish law, are actually important in some respect will use it to hide their previous records. And at least in the way the court ruling was set out, if there was a compelling public interest to keep the search results public, to not hide it, then it would remain public. But the companies that are responsible for making that judgment are Google. So,
Have they ever been... I hear here that there is going to be a maximum fine of £500,000 to any firm that decides not to comply with this new kind of like policy.
Right.
Are there any examples of that actually happening?
You mean previously?
Mm.
So the previous, like under the Data Protection Act in the UK, which I think was based on an EU regulation, the previous maximum fine was £500,000 for a general data breach. The overall fine for a data breach now is £17 million or will be under the new legislation. So the fining powers have gone up. You didn't previously have the right to actually request that your personal details were deleted. So that, like the £500,000 thing under the new regime is entirely novel. Sorry, what was your original question?
Has it ever happened? Have firms ever actually been
fined? So I think Sony were fined £400,000 for a data breach on their one of their video game networks, mm-hmm. because the email addresses and that sort of thing of users were leaked. I don't know if there are any payment card details. There's kind of a hierarchy of details, like email address and password. Assuming it isn't a significant account, it's mm-hmm. like, it's kind of bad, but no one really gives a shit. And then you have payment card details, which are a notch above that, because you've obviously got a risk of identity or financial fraud. And then above that, you've got like social service and health details, mm-hmm. Which are considered like, there have been a ton of like councils and health trusts in the UK that have lost their patients or their charges records and have ended up paying fines for doing so. Mm-hmm. So the UK regime is kind of regarded as, in the EU context at least, it's fairly tough as it goes. It's just that the previous EU rules were written in like 1998, and so the IT landscape slightly. Had changed a little yeah. bit since then. I think like the new finding powers are great. And I think the more interesting question is that because data has moved from being effectively a proprietary asset of the tech companies, Google, Facebook, etc., mm-hmm. and is now more the asset of the consumer, that has implications for the business models of all the tech firms. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm. Taha, what would you want to be forgotten about your internet past?
I did change Twitter before I started doing YouTube.
Mm-hmm. As in you set up a new account? Or?
Yeah. So I set up a new account just because I... But that was because I just only did video game stuff before. Mm-hmm. So I guess...
So there's no like embarrassing pictures of you getting drunk and snorting cocaine off hookers' tits or anything like that?
At the age of like 13.
Well, you know, kids grow up fast these days. Yeah. That's the way that some in the media have portrayed
interpreted it.
Yeah, is that like, oh, it will allow... The Guardian ran an opinion piece where it said it allows young people to have an imperfect... life, basically, mm-hmm. which I think is true. I mean, where you draw the dividing line between what is legitimate to be recorded in the public domain and what mm-hmm. is illegitimate, I don't know how stringently the guidance kind of sets that out. It'll obviously be down to interpretation to a certain degree.
You were telling me a little earlier that this could potentially highly affect companies that have focused quite significantly on the mass collection of data on individuals.
That's all marketing data, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially social media, because it's essentially social media is essentially just a mechanism to serve ads to demographics.
Yeah.
And
I mean, a lot of the internet search engines and a lot of other stuff is the same.
Their key asset is the fact that they can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And so if everyone has the ability to request them to delete it, they're essentially putting all of the business models in jeopardy.
Yeah, I mean, there's also kind of connected thing that skepticism around online advertising mm-hmm. is growing. There's a lot more concerns around fraud, mm-hmm. i.e. bots clicking adverts and being registered as legitimate mm-hmm. Ad viewers. They're Procter & Gamble, which has, I think, said in the Sunday Times, the biggest advertising budget in the world, have stopped using online advertising.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily see this as like a massive tide turning, but I think the online advertising model, which is what Google's entire fortune is based on,
and Facebook,
is kind of junk. Like, it obviously has some value, but it probably doesn't have the value that mm-hmm. you know their revenues would suggest.
It's actually something that, because I do some freelance marketing on the side, and it's something that I try and encourage clients to think about, is the fact that, okay, if you get a load of eyeballs on something, does that actually fucking matter?
Yeah.
And that's what so many of these so many of these companies rely on, is just like the idea that eyeballs are money. But actually, marketing is a lot more nuanced than that, and can be a lot more nuanced than that.
Mm. I also just want to note that I feel like a lot of the stuff they gather is just not true.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I've just opened my Twitter analytics, and
it's telling me
that I can know the household income categories of my followers.
I think you'd be surprised, man. like
from their tweets. You could,
yeah,
you
possibly.
Yeah, from like age and location and stuff like that.
I mean, Amazon.
That's where they estimate it from.
Amazon.
Sorry to burst your
Amazon. We're talking about this product in future, which would be able to not only guess which books you'd want to buy, but would deliver them to your house before even you knew you wanted to read them. And I find it plausible that they could develop that sort of product because
no, they get it so wrong.
Yeah, and the suggestions.
My
suggestions are pretty good, to be honest with you.
No,
but maybe I'll have boring choices.
My suggestions end up being adverts for things I've just bought on Amazon for the next 2 weeks.
That does happen. Yeah.
And for a very long time, Facebook thought that I was a Chinese student studying in the UK, and they were feeding me Chinese ads saying, "Do you want to go home yet?" And I was like, "Bloody hell!" Like for flights and things.
But
I was
you think,
you were close.
You think the income thing is correct?
Yes.
All right. Not sure how we tally those two things, but fair enough. I mean, do you have? You were saying you found it kind of. I mean, maybe you were saying this is a devil's advocacy thing, but do you find it a bit sinister that somebody can just eliminate the online record of true statements of things that happened in the past?
I think that rather than being able to do that, there needs to be more education about one's digital footprint. Which of course is a lot more, is a lot longer and a lot more nuanced and takes time, and people being digitally literate as well. Like for example, I don't think my 75-year-old granddad is really going to understand why when a Nigerian emails him, he shouldn't really pluck up a conversation. But I think that you can only really, I think that giving people the right to erase their pasts. Apart from in specific circumstances, which I wouldn't be able to articulate right now, I don't think that that is something that should happen. But I think that people from a very young age should be made acutely aware of the consequences of having a large digital footprint.
I have a question.
Okay.
Would you advocate or would you agree to the right to be forgotten for people under the ages of 18?
Kind of like a criminal record. So if you commit Snapchat. If you commit most crimes before the age of 18, by the time you get 18, your criminal record gets wiped in the UK. Those are exceptions, but generally speaking.
In principle, yeah. I'd have to look at the detail.
I feel like people.
Do you think of that as the person who's closer to 18 than both of us?
As a representative,
as a young person to her, please
yes.
do tell.
Well, I do feel like there does need to be some sort of leeway for young people being able to use the online space without feeling like it's going to be on there forever. And especially because a lot of people use the internet before they're literate and before their parents have the skills to parent them
mm-hmm.
on what's going on.
Mm.
And so there is something to be said about this might be a tool to tool for parents and guardians to help protect their kids from mistakes that they've made. Posting things that perhaps they didn't really understand the implication of
mm-hmm.
forever yet with.
Yeah, I'm skeptically or tentatively on board with something like that. Sounds good, Taha. I'm down.
Taha for Prime Minister.
No, terrible idea. You'd only do Prime Minister's questions once every 6 months.
Hey.
I think the public would be in favour of that, to be honest with you. It's not a bad idea.
Shall we wrap up?
Yeah, unless anything else.
Taha, where can they find you on the internet if they want to applaud or berate you?
The place that you can applaud and berate me is on Twitter at @KhanStopMe, KHANSTOPME.
Well done.
Or you can...
Jazzy wouldn't have been able to do that.
And if you want to see potentially funny things that I upload once every 6 months... Then...
He's got a very good back catalogue on YouTube.
Yeah, of funny things that hopefully will become more and more political, more and more informative.
Please do. We need more of you. Especially seeing as I only do gay stuff now.
Yeah, I'm coming for your job, Chazza.
What's my job, Taha?
Being resident British political commentator.
We'll talk about that off mic. Jimmy, where can they find you?
at JDE Nichols.
And you can find me at great. Yeah, they know it's Twitter. If you put an at the beginning of the bloody statement, they
whoa,
know.
Whoa, Google use app, don't they? Is that a thing? Google Plus? I don't know.
No, they use Plus.
Does anyone use Google Plus these days?
No. I bet if there were more female coders, Google Plus would have done brilliantly.
Yeah. In fact, that might actually be true.
Yeah, I know, right?
Because they did say that biologically they're more people-oriented.
That is true. So, you'd want women to design your social network.
I don't know how I feel about that statement. Yeah. My name's Jazza, I'm at Jazza John. Please leave us a review on iTunes because it feeds our dark, dark souls.
Someone did review us on iTunes.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Oh, should have read that out. Oh, well.
Oh, we can read it out. There's still time.
I'm very tired. I just want you to leave.
I've reviewed you on iTunes and I didn't get a readout.
You have had a readout.
You've appeared on the podcast twice.
Yeah, also, you've been on the podcast two times.
Well, what do you want? Most people who write a review don't get a appear on the podcast.
Most of them. Anyway, bye.